My lords, ladies, and gentlemen, this is a great moment for LSE, in a great year for LSE. The publication of the history by Lord Dahrendorf is really at the heart of our centenary celebrations. In fact, it was one of the first moves we made when we were starting to plan the program of centenary events. The history of the school project, as it was called, was started, sparked up, I'd put it that way, by Dr. Patel in his term of directorship. He set in train the whole process that's got us to this climax tonight. He set up the steering committee and the board of advisors, many of whom I see here tonight, and it was his inspiration to invite Ralph to accept what had seemed like a mission impossible for 100 years. Well, the question is, why hadn't it happened before this history? Why not? Well, it was thought about for the 50th anniversary, and in 1942 a committee was set up to explore whether this was going to be possible. And but then resources were scattered, documents were scattered, school was in Cambridge, nothing came of it, but Hayek did write an account for, I think, the Economica. It was a bare record, according to Carl Saunders. Later director, Sidney Kane, whose son I'm delighted to see here tonight, he, in his in a brilliant focus of cool, calculated account of the foundation period. And that was about it, really. There have been many flashes of lightning from memoirs and articles. But in fact, well, nothing has been attempted on this full scale before. And when you read it, I think you'll agree with me that it was probably worth waiting 100 years to have the man for the moment. And after all, Ralph Dahrendorf has had a career of crossing frontiers, and we have an institutional habit of crossing frontiers. If one thinks of his whole career, born in Hamburg, a fierce boyhood in Berlin, as part of a family in the active resistance against the Nazis, his father reigned after the July plot, he himself in a camp in 44-45 as a kid. Then a distinguished professor of philosophy, doctor of philosophy after the war, and he came to us in 52-54, taking his PhD in 56. He was immediately distinguished in his role as professor of sociology at Hamburg, and was a leader of the foundation of the new Konstanz University in 65. By then, he was moving into politics as a liberal member and a minister in Willy Brandt's government in the 60s, and in 1970 he was appointed a member of the Commission of European Communities in the EC, first for foreign trade and relations, then science and education and research. All absolutely ideal preparation for this job in 74 to 84. And since his time as a director, the honors have piled up. I think there are 23 honorary degrees on the last count. He was created Life Peer in 93, and he paid us the compliment of adopting us in his style as the Baron of Clare Market in the city of Westminster, and that compliment was deeply felt. Scholar here, leader here, and here is where we think of his home ground, even though he's Warden of St. Anthony's at Oxford. Now, all these strands of achievement seem to me to become evident in this quite extraordinary, compelling book. I got it just before the weekend, and it's no bedside read, I promise you. I heard you, Ben, said you were going to read it to your wife at night. I tell you, it is no bedside book. You are sitting upright. It'll have and command attention. The world, I think, will sit upright, not only LSE. It's extraordinary the way, if you say full-scale history, what does that mean? I ask myself what it means. It means something to me in three dimensions. The first dimension is the history of the institution. This is critical. He tells the story, as you might imagine, with tremendous scholarship and the facts and the figures, but also an exhilarating humanity. Of all the things I've read of yours, Ralph, I have never known you write with such relish and such, in a sense, sort of surprising joy. Every now and again you say, alas. Every now and again there's a minute you quote, 1905, from a Treasury committee. I have a copy of it here. It said, this is a Treasury committee being good to LSE, you see. 1905. This institute, although of a somewhat novel and special nature, deserves encouragement by the state. And Ralph says, those were the days. there's a sense of you having enjoyed what is a colossal task. When you wear it in your hands, it is a formidable achievement. But with it is an extraordinary free spirit. He writes from the position of a man who has been deeply involved and concerned with the institution and remains deeply attached to it. He particularly writes, I think, through the experiences of the 10 directors that we've had in our history. That is an interesting point of view which he makes quite clear in his introduction. He is writing this from the point of view of a director, and directors have a special place in this book, as you put it, Ralph. But throughout the narrative, I sense something really quite special for me, because I was never here. So for me, this is a thriller. There is an extraordinary sense of the dimensions of the book in the narrative about us, but also as he does that, and he talks about the constellation of the stars we have, these directors are stars, by which we've designed our course. But he also finds a glowing paragraph with the head porter, Dodson, the ex-mariner, you know, who roughly knew everything that went on in this building, apparently, and was mentor to the students and advisor to the staff for 27 years. I mean, so the book has a proportion which comes down to the individual and a sense of individuals with individual fingerprints on the job of 100 years. And you get the high politics of education, of course, and the formidable stresses and strains of the intellectual life of the school, but they're all actually earthed in a sense of how this unique place has sort of generated a prominent sense of community, a permanent sense of community, and of reality of its own, and of love. I speak, as I say, as a Corsican who came here some years ago, and he writes about it in those terms. And it's an interesting story to me because it's the story told, if you're looking at the history of the institution, of risk, people taking risks. This show began with risk. It's never been that certain. It's never been simple. It began with two young men, above all our founding fathers. One was 29, I think, when he was approached, and the other was 35, that's Sidney Webb and Huens. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Now, that risk was there, but at the same time, even then, there were all special characteristics of what I think of as the creative tensions in LSE, and they were there to see between academic theory and practical action in the muddle of the world, as Wells, no friend of ours really, put it. But we have seen this tension for ourselves between scholarship and then the left and right and center of politics, between scientific inquiry and the partisanship of commitment. And over the century, these contrary forces helped to shape the evolution of the social sciences that we've come to know them in this country. That's the achievement of this place, this enormous contribution to that articulation of the social sciences. and the contribution they've made, successes and failures, and the challenge they've faced. That's the second dimension of this book for me. And the third dimension comes because Ralph, in early stages, analyzes the currents of thought at our birth that were dominating the scene. He calls them the big E's of education, economics, equality, eugenics, and empire. And there's an eerie symmetry, not a fearful symmetry, a kind of eerie symmetry about those priorities then and now at the end of the century. Then and now, the empire suffered an eclipse. I think Ralph puts Europe in its place. You could put environment too, I suppose. But that is the third dimension when Ralph starts talking about the future. The first century, he tells us, made the school a precious asset. His words, for London, for Britain, for the social sciences, for a world in need of informed change. This book ends absolutely enthrallingly with formidable questions about not what next. I've always thought of Ralph as this man crossing the frontiers, and here we are suddenly brought to the edge of the next millennium, that frontier. He puts it in his last few pages, living with conflict is itself a virtue. There's no answer to Max Weber's dilemma of politics as a vocation and science as a vocation. I would regard that in my Blakean language as living with the contrary state of the soul. I'm cheered, however, by the sense of momentum he gives us in this book, and we can carry into the next 100 years in a characteristic flash of Ralph. It's a wise and witty way. He finishes by talking of being difficult for an individual to be both ascetic and worldly, but LSE, throughout its 100 years, has been exactly that. Now, these are days when universities in general and social sciences in particular seem to be going through a phase of a valley of dissipation and doubt, as your words there, Ralph. But we've a lot going for us the last 100 years, and a dynamic realism in this remarkable community of scholars and students. I find this a noble book, and the masterly way it's been written is noble, and the story it tells has nobility about it. And from my point of view, thinking about the centenary, Ralph, you know, great celebrations go on, and then suddenly there's nothing left. There's a marvelous Japanese poem, a haiku, one of those 17-syllable poems, which says, John Pike will correct me if I'm wrong, kaeru shito, hanabi no ato no kuraki kana. Kaeru shito means people returning. After the fireworks, hanabi is fire flower, which means fireworks in Japan. Hanabi no ato no, it can be darker, it can seem darker. After our celebration of 100 years, it could seem dark if you look at the next 100. But I suspect after our celebrations, illuminated in this lasting way, in this fine work, it'll seem lighter for us, Ralph, at LSE.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Peter, for this lovely review, which I hope will be given the widest possible publicity. In fact, no newspaper or magazine should be allowed to write anything else about the book, anything other than your kind and sympathetic and friendly words. For me, this is a long-awaited day. It's also a slightly dreaded day, of course, because now the book is no longer mine. It's somewhere out there. It's in your hands. It's in the hands of the world. Someone who likes me and wants to look after me suggested that Ellen and I should take a plane away somewhere tonight, because so many of you and many others will open the book and look at the index and either failed to find yourselves, or if you find yourselves, find something which you don't like at all. But then where should we go on that plane? Because LSE is everywhere. It is hard to think of a destination anywhere in the world where we could escape the proximity of LSE. And so the idea was that today we would have a party of friends, a party of friends who, many of whom have helped in producing the book, many of whom have given valuable advice, others have facilitated the work, and others are personal friends. And I would like to mention very quickly four part groups, not repeating what I say in the introduction, which is easy to read, on appreciating the help of others. I am deeply grateful to the school, and especially to I.G. Patel and John Ashworth, to Christine Chalice, to the librarians and archivists, and all those who have been not only extremely helpful, but helpful without asking embarrassing questions. And I would like to say that this is really quite a remarkable phenomenon. Here's the school, through its chairman, recommending a book which many of those who run the school have not yet read or have just begun to read. There has never, ever been the slightest attempt by the school to interfere in any way in the writing of this book. I'm grateful for that. It has confirmed the reasons for my deep affection for this institution. I also would like to thank the Oxford University Press. I always wanted to produce a book which sort of feels good. And while I have produced about 40, I don't think any one of them feels as good as this one. And I'm really pleased about that. It has a sort of solid and at the same time pleasing feel, and perhaps the happiest people will be those who just feel it. But I am grateful to... there's also something else about it which I never thought I would do. It's got pictures in it. It's not exactly a coffee table book, but it's one which has illustrations, which is great. And so I'm grateful to Tony Morris and Anne Gelling and Julia Dingle and many others at the Oxford Press. Thirdly, I have to mention especially Shirley Chapman. Without Shirley Chapman, I have to tell you, this book would not be here. And it's not just that she organized the history of the school unit. She had this extraordinary confidence in me, which at times was quite undeserved, so far as I'm concerned, but which encouraged me. There was a great moment, after all, we've been working on this for nearly 5 years, when she actually said to me, with the candor, which is one of her many qualities, "I know that you haven't written anything yet, but I'm quite sure at the end of the day you will produce." And how right she was. But that was just the encouragement I needed. And she has been encouraging like this throughout. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful to her. And then I would like to say a special word of thank you to my Oxford friends, not only for having endured a 2-hour train journey instead of 50 minutes, an experience only too familiar to someone who commutes to London from Oxford twice a week, and I can feel with him, but above all for having endured a warden who had this other interest, and an interest which engages passions as well as time. There are quite a few LSE people at St. Anthony's College, that is LSE graduates or people who've taught here at St. Anthony's, and there are times actually when I feel that St. Anthony's is a sort of, is LSE in the form of a small business. Now, small businesses are much harder to run, of course, than large and medium-sized ones in which you have an organization and an organization chart behind which you can hide. Small businesses notice much earlier when they are about to go bankrupt than big businesses, although perhaps the effect of such dreaded events is not quite as earth-shaking as it is in the case of some of the larger ones. But I find a lot of similarity in the internationalism and commitment in the combination and cooperation of the social sciences, and so I've never found it difficult to combine my commitment to St. Anthony's with my old love of the London School of Economics. It is, as you said, Peter, in many ways a book of passion. I don't want to describe it to you at all because it's now there. There is an overall story, which is the great story of the boundary between scholarly inquiry and the social sciences and what happens in the world outside among those who take decisions. And it is an explosive story, inevitably. And so it's not surprising that every now and again in the history of the school there were actual explosions, almost invariably around this kind of issue. And it is this issue which has led me to say, don't let us kid ourselves. There isn't any great theoretical answer to this. This is something one has to live with and live with decently. And in its best periods, the school has managed to do that. And in its difficult periods, it's fought for an answer which again involved living decently with these great conflicts. And there are quite a few people in this room today who have made such a major and important contribution to that particular achievement. So that's the overall story. But then there's the story of the foundation, which is really quite fascinating, and where I tried to bring out really the surprising fact that from nothing, and incidentally, one factor you didn't mention, within a matter of 6 months, from nothing, there came about the first term, the first academic year of the London School of Economics in 1895. There is the story of the second foundation, which is the Beveridge Years, which in many ways, to me, is the center of the book. It's an extraordinary achievement, again, with a lot of incident and pain for some, and with a very unhappy end for a director whom I regard as the greatest among in the history of the first century of LSE. An unhappy end, but an unhappy end to a great success story, which is still the basis of the enormous strength of LSE. And then there is the time of challenges and responses of a variety of kinds. Again, fascinating, the war and coming back after the war. The war, the two wars, really, which I tried to describe, the one in Cambridge, where LSE almost became a women's college, rather cozy and quite agreeable, so much so that some never wanted to come back to the untidy and slightly chaotic world of Houghton Street. And the other war of the many, many members of the school who were involved in policy making in one way or another, were advising government, were all over the world in important positions. There's the great challenge of the post-war expansion, Butler expansion in schools and the Robbins expansion in universities. There is the great challenge of the Troubles, to which I've tried to do justice, a very difficult thing to do. And there is the challenge of having to defend the social sciences in particular and universities in general in an environment which, since the late 1960s really, has increasingly turned against higher education in this country. All this the school has coped with an enormous resilience, and a resilience which has made it a rather happy task to write that final section in which I speculate on how the strength of LSE will enable the school to move successfully and with similar effect into its second century. So it was a great thing for me to do. It did involve years of my life, but years to which I like to think back because of the many who have helped and who became friends, and because of the continuing commitment to this great institution. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much, Ralph. That's it. Thank you.